Okay,
yeah,
it just
what the same. This meeting of the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5524. Mr. Wilson.
Just a quick note. First of all, we're starting on page 116, which was just up there, and we'll be back up. I just wanted to note that this may be Julie's last day with us. She's in a program, I think at Western, so she's doing a student teaching experience that will likely be in the morning. So this is the committee she's going to have to give up. So we'll have someone new. Michael will be in on Monday. And so I'm sure we'll miss her. Who knows? Maybe she'll be back toward the end of session. Who knows? But she says this is her favorite subcommittee, but I'm not sure if she said to everyone.
At least the favorite she's going to miss.
Well, yeah. Julie's certainly our favorite, and we wish you well with your educational endeavors and so on. Having gone through student teaching and taught for 25 or 30 years, you're looking forward to a great life. Senator Thompson.
I just want to say I'm going to miss her, too. And if she's leaving, I'm leaving.
See, there's a silver lining to every cloud.
Yeah. Oh, good one.
That was pretty good. That was quick, too.
I think we should move on.
Quick. Mr. Wilson, why don't we bring Mr. Cannon up again and his cohorts.
I also should note that you'll notice that the CFO analyst has changed. Lisa Pearson sat in for a few days. Patrick is here he's actually the analyst assigned to this agency for the CFO's office.
Okay, we'll accept that, I guess. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, executive director for the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. At the outset, I'll note the letter that you should just have received from me, dated March 30th, with responses to questions that arose during yesterday's testimony. I won't go over that now, but if there are questions, please feel free to follow up with me or our staff. We did attach an additional slide at Representative Smith Warner's request that shows that Oregon Promise enrollment as a percentage of college FTE and answered some other questions as well.
And Mr. Chair, that should be posted on yesterday's hearing on OLIS.
Okay. So 29th?
Yes.
Okay.
Picking up where we left off, we were in the sort of final set of slides related to the affordability section of our testimony. It's focused on our Office of Student Access and Completion, or OSAC, where the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise, and other affordability-related initiatives are led by the HEC, but through our OSAC office in Eugene. I'm going to turn it back over to our interim director, Juan Baez Arevalo, to continue and describe in the final section here other programs beyond the Oregon Promise and Oregon Opportunity that OSAC leads that are related directly to affordability.
Welcome back, Juan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Juan Baez Arevalo, Interim Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. The Oregon Child Care Grant offsets student child care expenses. It's a very small program that served 87 student parents in 2015-16. The governor's recommended budget proposes a modest increase for this program from $948,000 to $984,000 for the 2017-19 biennium. The eligibility criteria for this program includes that the student parent must be an Oregon resident with a child or legal dependent aged 12 and under, enrolled in or accepted for enrollment as an undergraduate student, and the student must be maintaining satisfactory academic progress.
How many are we talking about? How many parents and children are in this program?
87 received the award in 2015-16.
Okay.
Yeah. The Chafee Education and Training Grant helps current or former foster youth. Eligible youth may receive up to $5,000 per academic year. For 2016-17, a total of $775,816 has been awarded to 184 students to date. The scholarships for children of deceased or disabled public safety officers. The applicants for this scholarship must be dependents of an officer who was killed or disabled in the line of duty. Eligible public safety officers includes firefighters, police, parole and probation officers, and investigating officers for the Criminal Justice Division. For 2016-17, we expect seven students to receive a total of $39,271. The Just Plus individual education accounts, each year about 100 TANF clients earn funds to use post-secondary training. In 2015-16, 32 clients redeemed $15,235 from their individual education accounts. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps in 2015-16, about 21 students redeemed $16,184 in scholarships. And the Barber and Hairdressers Grant, that's a very small program. And these grants are based on the interest earnings, and they vary from $225 to a maximum of $1,000 per participant. OSAC administers over 500 private scholarships. And a little bit of history on this. In 1983, OSAC began its work administering private scholarships by offering the Oregonian Publishing Company scholarship at the suggestion of the Oregon Community Foundation. And today, OSAC administers over 500 scholarships through one online application. It is worth noting that Oregon is one of two state agencies in the United States that provides centralized scholarship services. The other agency is in the state of Vermont. OSAC has a unique public and private partnership with the Oregon Community Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, and these successful partnerships have benefited a great number of Oregonians through the years. During the 15-16 academic year, more than $18 million in private scholarships were awarded to nearly 3,600 students. The award amounts range from $500 to $18,000, with an average of about $2,500. In this time period, OSAC added 25 new scholarships to its portfolio. Two years ago, OSAC was requested by this legislative body that we return in 2017 and provide you with a report on the sustainability of the administration of the private scholarships program. During the last 18 months in the course of this biennium, the program is demonstrating to be self-sustainable. This is particularly true when we focus on direct labor costs for the program and one applies a cost allocation that distributes office-specific and agency-wide indirect costs. The forecast for the rest of the 15-17 biennium is that the program will be self-sustainable. It will be in the positive. A key element that influences the sustainability of the program is that we have some very small scholarships that cost us more to administer than what we're able to recover. They are generally pass-through funds and for which we award an invoice on an annual basis. These awards are so small that, as I mentioned, they cost us a lot more to administer them than what we're able to receive in administrative charges from these partnerships. Now, to increase the sustainability...
There's no way to amalgamate those so that there's increased efficiency in administration?
Mr. Co-Chair, I'm Co-Chair of Members of the Committee. Yes, we are working with them as a group, right? But individually, when we account the cost for that individual scholarship, it does cost us more. And so since we are... we recover our administrative expenses on the individual scholarship program. It costs us more than we're able to receive. So as a group, that bundle, there's a group within the bundle that costs us more. And that's those small scholarships are the ones that carry a loss, if you will. And so what we're looking at is increase efficiencies and how we can better manage those since they're very, very small. And obviously being able to share the cost across all the 535 programs, are they sustainable? And I think that's the big question that we've had. Can, as a bundle, be sustainable? And the answer to that is yes, they can be, as a bundle, sustainable. But the very small ones by themselves would not be.
Okay. These are from, like, individuals that bequeathed a certain amount of their estate to this program, and then you administer the, or determine who gets the results, the scholarships?
Ms. Co-Chair, you are correct. This is individual scholarships that either a citizen or a nonprofit organization or a corporation seeks to establish. And they set certain amounts of monies to award the scholarships. When they're very, very small, it does cost us more to administer them. So one of the things that OSAC began doing at the beginning of 2016 is to require a set of minimum requirements for establishing new private scholarship funds. And that requirement is a minimum deposit of $3,600.
Okay.
So we're looking at small amounts of money, and obviously with the efficiencies and effectiveness that OSAC has demonstrated, they're able to process those effectively and make it self-sustainable.
Senator Roblin.
And I think the most important, from my perspective, part of this whole program is they also work with the Oregon Community Foundation, who many people have sent money to, and they have their individual accounts as well. So they manage those, but it is through the process that we have at the state that allows all of that to go to one application. So Marshfield High School has a scholarship fund. It has about $3 million in it, maybe a little bit more, that is now in the Oregon Community Foundation. But there's a local board of people at the high school who go through all the applications that they get through OSAC and distribute the money. And we pay a fee to Oregon Community Foundation. I don't know if they help with your stuff, but of that money. So we're only giving scholarships out on the interest incurred. And so we give lots of scholarships. North Bend does a similar thing, but they run their own. But they still use the common interface that OSAC has provided, which has made it really amazing, actually, from a perspective of a school district. Because when you get on that form, there's a whole bunch of these other scholarships that are out there that are they go unclaimed because nobody knows that they're a relative of the last name of whatever that's out there worldwide. And OSAC is helping us gather up that stuff for Oregon's kids because they might. And I can't say enough about this. If you haven't gone through and looked at what their application form does and how it interfaces with kids, they help with the FAFSA. I mean, all of these things are connected now, which is really amazing for kids who are willing to go through and search and find the stuff that can work for them.
Yeah. Senator Thompson.
I was just curious, Arnie, if you could follow up for me. Is the interest rate better with that?
I will tell you that we tried to manage our own at our school, mm-hmm. and just managing it and investing it was such a big hassle that we couldn't do it. Oregon Community Foundation does all that for us, so we're happy with what they get for us. And they've done pretty well over time with respect to interest rates. But I will tell you, if you try to do it yourself, North Bend still does it themselves. I give them a lot of credit for doing that. Different schools can do it whatever the way they want,
sure.
but
okay.
having one place to go through to get an application form so all the application forms look alike, it's pretty remarkable. But
of course, I know some individuals, of course, that have an attachment to a particular college
right.
Can set up an endowment.
Absolutely.
My wife and I, when we're gone in another 50 years or so,
Most of our estate will go to scholarships at Warner Pacific College because I have a connection there.
But you can get find out about some of those through some of the same stuff.
Yeah.
So that I know I'm going there, and it'll tell you that they have particular scholarships. So it's really pretty amazing and helps our kids.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, one thing I would like to highlight is that, in fact, that one common online application, it creates those efficiencies and effectiveness, and it helps individuals, if you will, identify through that mechanism other scholarship opportunities that they might qualify for. So it is a remarkable process that helps a great number of Oregonians. And as we continue to closely monitor the self-sustainability of this program, I'm certain that we will find some efficiencies and greater effectiveness. As it is today, it is very effective. And one thing is for certain, I think is more of a reflective point, is that with $18 million of private funds awarded to 3,600 Oregonians, the private scholarship program is well worth the effort.
Members of the committee will wrap up the affordability section of the presentation just by reviewing a couple of the funding figures, especially those related to general fund and lottery fund budgets. Here's the essentially the sort of scholarships budget by fund source. So of the programs we've described, including the Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise, the various state-administered and private scholarship programs that we've covered over the last couple of days, you see the breakdown here by fund type. The majority, of course, general fund, and that's due to the size of the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Oregon Promise is the largest of these scholarship programs. But you see also the lottery funds and other funds that comprise a portion of our state scholarships budget. And here are the major line items in a what should be a now familiar format of a budget slide that describes the 2015-17 legislatively approved budget and then shows in the two right-hand columns the 2017-19 CSL and GRB. Again, just to highlight in the governor's budget, the proposed increase to the opportunity grant over and above the CSL increase. So in total, it would be about a $10 million increase over LAB to the opportunity grant in order to serve more low-income students. You see here the also, in the governor's budget, the nearly fourfold increase in the Oregon Promise grant program in order to continue serving eligible students in that program. You see the very modest in the third and final section of this, the very modest increase in the student child care grant. And in other respects, the governor's budget reflects a CSL approach for the other very small state programs that we've described under this section of the budget presentation.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that student child care grant, I know that, so the House Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, has talked a lot in the budgeting process about the many things that we kind of do through multiple different areas and ways and parts of the budget. And I would just wonder, given that that is the student child care grant, and it is a small amount that serves a small amount of people. Is that, and I'm not, you might not know the answer, is this the most efficient way to use that? Is there any other, like, is there another way we could do this that somehow we might be able to increase, broaden its reach or make kind of that particular chunk of money do more and be able to impact or help more students?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the
student
committee.
Student parents, I should say.
I am not... I don't know. I don't think this is a program that has, to my knowledge, at least recently been reviewed with that sort of broader lens. It is a program that continues to benefit students, a relatively small number of them, however. I think our view would likely be that as long as the state has a continued interest in providing scholarship dollars to student parents, our scholarship office is an appropriate place to do so, because that's what we do, is scholarships. That said, We would certainly be open to a conversation about other mechanisms to provide support for student parents that were, you know, in conjunction with programs and other agencies. I don't think that sort of larger sort of review has taken place recently.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
So as you're looking at all of the opportunities you have to help kids get their education paid for, do you keep that in mind so that if kids qualify for another place over here, you'll encourage them to go that direction as opposed to this one, so that as many people as can find their place in here, and just keep that one as one of those sources that may have no other conditions, therefore it can be used by those kids that don't have those? And is that something you organize at OSAC?
Senator Roblin, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, certainly with the one common application and the efficiencies and effectiveness that we have at OSAC, there are ways for the system to identify individuals and for individuals to identify the resources within there that would benefit them. I think this is a very valuable program. Obviously, the as a administrator, former K-12 administrator, and someone that oversees private post-secondary as well, I was recently at a graduation ceremony and gave a commencement speech for one of our private career schools, the Institute of Technology here in Salem. And the majority of the graduates were single moms. And I could think of this program and how that could benefit all of those single parents who could have benefited from it. I think part of the function is that the amounts are very, very small that we have for this program. Is there a greater need? Yes. And that is one of those realities. So I think even if there's a more efficient, effective way to administer this, and I would argue that OSAC is best positioned to do it, the limited amount of funds, it also constrains it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Co-chairs, we are ready. We're at a sort of transition point to the next section of our presentation. Just remind you where we are in the schedule. We've walked through days 1, 2, and 3, and we're transitioning now to the part of day 4 and then all of day 5, the student pathways and transitions section. And I'll sort of frame that up over the next couple of slides and give you a better sense of what we mean by pathways and transitions. But I'll introduce that topic by noting again the budget priority that our request places around sustaining investments to improve and simplify student pathways. And I guess let me put it like this. If you think about the reasons for having an organization like the HEC, a coordinating commission with broad responsibility for higher education and workforce training in Oregon, pathways, transitions, student progress between institutions, between K-12 and higher ed, between higher ed institutions themselves, and between higher education and training and the workforce is central to an organization like ours. We exist in part to help, in significant part, to help coordinate those institutions and activities in order to create clearer, more coherent, and more successful pathways for Oregon students to certificate and degree and to the workplace. So the next section of our presentation, the next sort of day and a half of our slides, will focus on those intersections and transitions. We'll describe that in really three chunks. One is pre-college preparation and transitions for youth and adults. So transitioning into higher education from the workplace or from K-12, transitioning into training. It's not just college and university. And so this initial section of the presentation will focus on sort of that transition into higher education and training. The second, the sort of middle section of this of the presentation will focus on academic transitions among and between post-secondary institutions. So the sort of classic example would be the community college student who seeks to transfer to a four-year university and how our work is helping to address that. And then finally, we'll look at the transitions to career. and from post-secondary education and training into career, and we'll focus on some of the workforce programs and initiatives that we help to support. This is a challenging area of our work to get a handle around from a budget standpoint, because it is work that's done by a lot of staff within our agency with various portions of their time. We'll be describing a number of programs and activities that don't have specific dedicated budget lines, but yet constitute a significant portion of our staff's work. So the overarching budget slide here shows the general fund that the legislature has appropriated and that we've requested for 17-19 to support our entire kind of operational budget of the HEC. That does that budget supports much more than just our pathways and transitions work, but certainly a chunk of the $24 million general fund that supports our operational budget in this biennium, and the 21.9 in our CSL, a chunk of that, and we'll get somewhat more specific as we can, a chunk of that helps to, is dedicated to really this pathways work. This is a very small fraction, of course, of the overall HEC budget, a general fund lottery fund budget of more than $1.8 billion, most of which, of course, is passed through to colleges and universities and students via financial aid. So it's a very small fraction of our overall HEC budget, but it's a very significant portion of the work that our staff does to coordinate higher education and workforce training in order to promote student success. Before we introduce some of those specific efforts, just note in this slide that this is work that's done, obviously, with many, many partners. They are some of which are listed here, including other state agencies, but importantly, K-12 school districts and schools, the tribes, community-based organizations. Well, we'll talk about our GED work. This is a large constellation of organizations and individuals throughout the state of Oregon with whom we work in order to try to build these pathways for success for students. There are related KPMs. Some of these are repeats from prior KPMs that we've noted, and we will report on all of these at the end of our presentation. But just to, as a sort of placeholder here, to note that these are some of the KPMs that connect to the pathways work that we'll talk about over the next day. And with that, I think we'll start into the pre-college transition. So transitioning to post-secondary from high school, from the workplace, or for Oregonians out of work and out of school, getting on that pathway to post-secondary success. There are a couple of programs, and we'll be talking about more than just these two, but that pre-college transition work is done in a variety of ways. Two of them are Aspire, which you'll hear about from Juan in just a moment. Another of which is the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, which you'll hear from Karen Hummelbaugh about in a few more minutes. Those budget numbers are here. Aspire is a $1.6 million general fund program in this biennium. The CSL budget for that and the GRB are at $1.8 million. OYCC, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, is a $2.6 million other funded program through a special revenue source, the amusement device tax, that we also have in our budget at $2.6 million. So a little change on the proposed funding for OYCC. This is simply a sort of budget slide that previews the programs, two of the programs that you'll hear about over the next few minutes related to pre-college transitions and pathways. With that, turn it back to Juan, because the Office of Student Access and Completion, in addition to operating scholarship programs, also engages young Oregonians and Oregonians seeking to return or enter college in financial literacy or financial access to college through programs like Aspire, FAFSA Plus, and our C3 Collaborative. And turn it back over to Juan.
Thank you. Indeed, OSAC has many impactful pre-college programs and outreach and coordination activities, such as Aspire, FAFSA Plus, and the Career College Collaborative. These are OSAC initiatives that seek to bring forth critical education, information, and outreach to communities across our state to address the lack of information and on the financial barriers, and also addressing the financial barriers of attending college.
Juan, can you explain how the Aspire program works? I've been very impressed with the efficiency and the cost effectiveness of Aspire. Some of our members on this subcommittee are new and may not be familiar with exactly how Aspire works.
Mr. Co-Chair, indeed, we will get into the Aspire program and review in detail what it does and the impact of it in this recent biennium. In slide number 143, I believe we're going to be starting to cover
the
Aspire
program.
You're
going to do it. That's fine.
Yes. Thanks, sir. So one thing about outreach, and the question comes to mind, is why is outreach important? And quite simply, many Oregonians, students, families lack the information and the skills and the resources to access college and achieve their college and career goals. HEX outreach activities through OSAC, with these several successful initiatives that OSAC has, they teach individuals and provide individuals with the resources to access and afford post-secondary education, engaging local communities, and this is something that Aspire program does very well, and collaborative partnerships to assist students and families to make informed choices and succeed. OSAC-led initiatives such as FAFSA Plus and College Goal Oregon and the administration of the Aspire mentoring program and the active collaboration with partners educate diverse audiences on how to pay for college, apply for state-administered financial aid, and access mentoring, which is a critical component of the Aspire program. Our staff convene and collaborate with pre-K to 20 partners on strategies to promote college and career readiness, and OSAC publishes and distributes information and resources on state financial aid programs, and through these partnerships and this outreach activities, that information is disseminated. OSAC staff, as indicated, conduct numerous events at diverse venues and to diverse audiences, from middle school and high school students to adult learners, parents, teachers, counselors, and other educators. 240 events throughout Oregon in 2015-17 covered a wide geographic spread of both rural and urban communities. OSAC staff at each one of these events gathers data and feedback in order to evaluate and to look for ways to improve. And one of the areas that we're looking to improve currently is how to better use technology in creating webinars and also how-to videos so that both local community partners, parents, can access those resources remotely and avail themselves of that information and guide themselves through effectively how to get to a completion of an application, say for these scholarship programs, for FAFSA, how to do that effectively, how to basically navigate through the various systems and barriers that might be out there for them. So
that is just so critical. We know that our young people, that their parents never went to college, especially rural areas, especially east of the mountains, that their opportunity to go to college simply does not match with that of students that come from a better, higher socioeconomic status or from urban areas, and one of my goals is to try and make college available and encouraged by all elements of our society Instead of this dichotomy that we see where, you know, you come from a rural community and your parents didn't go to college and you're not going to go to college. So we want to change that. We want everybody to have opportunities for higher education that's appropriate to their needs and desires.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Indeed, that is at the core of the work that we have at OSAC and our mission at OSAC. Yeah. And we have a group of staff who are highly committed to conduct outreach and support students and families and to get the word out, get the information out there. In fact, when I first started overseeing OSAC, I wondered who all does outreach, who's out there. And the easier answer was who wasn't. Because every single person pitches in and provides information to parents and individuals. And I myself look forward to going out there to schools and perhaps seeing some of my former students or teachers or parents and talking to them about attending college and how to get through the various application processes and systems to get them there and succeed. So one of the important critical factors of attending college is FAFSA and the completion of FAFSA. The importance of it is just simply critical for the students to access both federal aid and state aid. When students know how to obtain financial aid, which is one of those barriers, they're more likely to access and complete college. To be eligible for federal aid, such as the Pell Grant that we talked about a day ago, students must complete the free application for federal student aid, FAFSA. And that in itself can be complicated for students. Nationally, 90% of high school seniors who complete the FAFSA attend college directly, compared with only 55% of non-FAFSA completers. So that's a remarkable difference right there. In Oregon, 2016, we were slightly below the average for the percent of students who completed the FAFSA, yet outreach activities and initiatives from OSAC contributed to a significant increase in the total number of high school seniors that completed FAFSA. And that effort in 2016 led to Oregon being ranked as number one in the nation for such an increase. Of getting more students to complete the FAFSA, which is a critical important step for them to access the resources that are out there available.
Let me just pause on that point because I think it's quite significant. This increase, this year-over-year increase, was in the neighborhood of 10%. This was looking at the percentage of high school seniors who completed the FAFSA versus the prior year. A very significant increase between 2015 and 2016 attributable in part to the outreach efforts at OSAC and in part most likely to the Oregon Promise and its requirement that students complete a FAFSA in order to participate in the program.
Yeah, we require that as part of the Oregon Promise, and it's really increased it dramatically. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can I just ask a quick question about the $2.7 billion of federal Pell Grant aid that went unclaimed in 2014? Now, speaking as a legislator on a budget committee, I see that and I think, I can't imagine they don't sweep that every year or something. What, I mean, I'm astounded that at the federal level there could be that much money that they just don't get. I mean, is it that it doesn't go out? It's that because kids don't fill in the form? Is that money just sitting there waiting for me to pull down to Oregon for something else? Or? And you may not know the answer. I realize you are not federal budget writers.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the federal budgeting process. This is essentially an entitlement program. So
that's all right. Nobody back in D.C. is either.
So students get the money if they qualify, and there isn't a cap on it. So unlike an Oregon budget where there would be a limit, this, to my knowledge, is a program where estimates are made, and it is operated like an entitlement program. So as many students who qualify or receive the funds for it. I think this estimate of $2.7 billion is based less on the federal estimate of who would, or the federal budget of how many dollars have been set aside for the Pell Grant, and more on data related to the number of students in America who are attending college and university and who appear to be Pell eligible but who are not getting the Pell Grant because for whatever reason they've not completed the FAFSA.
Can I brief follow up?
Go ahead.
The idea that as a, I already lost the word, as an entitlement that you, there's not a cap? I thought there was kind of a maximum that you could qualify for as a Pell Grant.
Representative Smith-Morner, Co-Chair Monroe, at an individual level, yes.
Oh, there gotcha.
There is a maximum per individual, that's... and we can certainly follow up.
Oh, no. No, I just, that's what I had always thought. There was an individual.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Good to know.
Senator Roblin.
And there are a lot of reasons. We have a number of students whose parents do not want to give up their information that their earnings, and they cannot fill out a FAFSA if they don't have that information. So there are a lot of different reasons why people don't fill out those FAFSA forms. Even though OSAC tries to help and the Aspire people talk to parents and all those other kinds of things, they still make a decision they don't want the government having that information.
Yeah. Well, Trump's kids wouldn't be eligible.
Get to Pokemon Go.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yep.
The FAFSA Plus program that we were talking about is a year-round partnership program that includes FAFSA completion activities and support. OSAC currently participates in the National FAFSA Completion Initiative, allowing OSAC to share student-level FAFSA data with secondary schools and other designated entities like TRIO and GEAR-UP. OSAC not only shares the date that each student has filed a FAFSA, but also the participating sites can see whether the student's FAFSA has been selected for verification, which is a key process, and or has been rejected. With 221 high school and community partners across Oregon, OSAC's FAFSA Plus helps increase the completion rates of students, and partner sites are able to offer extra assistance to the students and their families who need to complete or make corrections to a rejected FAFSA. This initiative has grown relatively quickly from four sites in 2013-14 to the 221 in the current academic year. As of December 30th, 2016, participating FAFSA Plus high schools are serving 71% of Oregon public high school seniors with the assistance of student-level FAFSA Plus data. That is a remarkable effort.
Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I assume when you say FAFSAs are rejected, it has to do with lack of completion versus any other.
Representative Lively. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, that is correct. There are various factors when a parent or a child attempts to complete the FAFSA. If there's information that is missing or things that need to be verified, those are important flags. And if those things are not addressed properly, then one does not complete the application and can't access the Pell dollars that are just there waiting to be had, if you will, if one completes the process. And that is very important, that the application has to be complete and submitted. And if the individuals or the families expect a family contribution is to a certain level, that a Pell award can be made, and those Pell dollars we're talking about, and that individual attends college, they will receive that aid. So it is a process of going through the application, making sure that it's complete and accurate. And once that is done, that is key hurdle number one into accessing the resources that are available.
Thank you.
Just a key point on this FAFSA Plus program. Historically, it was the case if you were a student and your FAFSA was rejected, you learned that. If your FAFSA was accepted, you learned that. But your school or your partnering organization did not. What we're doing now in partnership with this data sharing agreement with the federal government is we're able to inform the school or the community-based organization that's supporting the student in completing the FAFSA who specifically from that school or that organization has successfully completed the FAFSA and who has not, which arms that advisor, counselor, teacher, whomever, with the information they need in order to help improve the FAFSA completion rates. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of the reason for the success.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I just want to commend you guys, if you go back to that slide for a second, how helpful it is to know that the 21 sites deals with the percentage of students that are impacted, because that's extremely helpful information for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
College Goal Oregon is a component of FAFSA Plus. It offers free statewide events to help students and families search and apply for federal aid. The College Goal Oregon events focus on providing key information and training to students and families, and with the financial aid information that we're talking about, providing guidance on scholarships, including OSAC scholarship application, and tips on how to complete the FAFSA. It's just another tool, another initiative that helps set out the good word, if you will, for individuals and families. During the 15-16 academic year, 49 sites hosted 80 events, and over 1,600 students attended a College Goal Oregon event. A remarkable amount of 230 event volunteers lend a hand to support College Goal Oregon events. Now, the Aspire program, Aspire is Oregon's college and career mentoring program. It helps students access education and training beyond high school. This critical program harnesses the power of local partnerships across the state and the energy of numerous numbers of volunteers. OSAC staff creates and maintains training resources and facilitates regional and statewide training events for the volunteers and the school site coordinators. In addition to delivering presentations and publishing resource materials, OSAC staff provides funding. OSAC provides funding to the local sites to support them and help them offset the costs associated with providing the program. Every time we have a new site agreement, the sites also commit some in-kind contributions, which could be the time of a counselor or a teacher or someone who will be coordinating it locally.
Now, we had a former member of this panel, Representative Springer, is a volunteer for the Aspire program, and she used to talk to us about how this happened and why she spent her time volunteering. The fact that they use these volunteer counselors is one of the reasons this program is so efficient in terms of its cost, in terms of its effectiveness.
Correct. OSAC, the Aspire program, is able to directly reach many students throughout the state, and it's through the effort of the volunteers. In 2015-16 academic year, the Aspire program was active in 157 sites statewide and served over 10,000 students through the service of those 1,500 volunteers, whose valuable time was calculated and valued at over $1 million. In 2015-16, 10,250 students were served through Aspire, and of these students, 35% of them identified themselves as students of color. 54% had at least one parent who did not attend college. The achievement of these students is that 67% of them applied for at least one scholarship, and 84% applied for financial aid. 92% of them applied to or are planning to attend at least one college or university or a technical vocational program within a year of high school. C3, or Career College Collaborative, is it's a new initiative, and HEC is participating in this Career College Collaborative known as C3. C3 is a promising new initiative of counselors, educators, who are mobilizing others to engage all students, particularly low-income students, on viable pathways to college and career readiness. OSAC staff provide the staffing support and the coordination and the convening of these partners. There are 44 members currently in this C3 partnership, and 13 partner organizations. Some of the accomplishments in the short period of time is hosting the 2016 Reach Higher Summit, a free conference for school administrators, school counselors, advisors, and college access professionals who, and the focus was to mobilizing career and college advising to support all students.
With that, members of the committee, I'm gonna we'll start to play a little bit of musical chairs here. I'm gonna invite Karen Hummelbaugh to take Juan's place at the table, because we're going to stay in the topic of supporting young Oregonians in gaining education and training, but focus on work that's led by Karen through a different office within the HEC, our Office of Workforce Investment. And Karen will describe the OYCC and other youth outreach work that her office leads.
Great, thank you.
Welcome.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hummelbaugh, and I am the director of the Office of Workforce Investments at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And in addition to the programs we just heard about, like the transition programs for C3, part of the exciting coordinating function that we have at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is that we have a variety of education and training and workforce pathways. And the agency houses two programs aimed at opportunity youth in particular. These are young people who are either at risk for not completing their secondary education, or they're already disconnected from that system. And we focus on assuring that they complete, but that also they receive hopefully a first work experience opportunity and hands-on exposure to the value of work and also career exploration. We know that not only is education important, but a first job is really important and critical to long-term success. I listened to you all discussing a little bit about the Great Recession and some of the effects that had on our post-secondary institutions. And the recession and recovery were particularly difficult for our young people, and they largely still haven't recovered. I've included on this slide at the bottom a hyperlink to a report called Endangered Youth in the Labor Force that our colleagues at the Oregon Employment Department produced. And it's a good read. I would encourage people to look at it. But it talks a lot about how our young people were left behind in the recession and the recovery. And the bottom line is that the unemployment rate for youth it remains high, and it's disproportionately high. In 2015, Oregonians aged 16 to 24 made up only 12% of the labor force, but they made up 27% of those unemployed. We know that the lack of work experience leaves young people without those critical work skills. If we think about the first jobs we all had, it keeps you engaged in school. It makes you understand what you want to do for your career long term. It teaches you problem solving, how to work in teams, those things we hear from businesses in terms of what they're looking for in individuals to show up for work, work a full day, and be engaged with their other coworkers. So helping young people find work experiences can serve as not only a retention strategy, as I discussed, but it also improves their long-term labor market outcomes. So we have two programs that serve youth. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps has a summer and school year program. The OYCC program combines both classroom and hands-on training, stewardship, and outdoor paid work experience. The program serves at-risk youth in all 36 counties in the state. And we run these programs through grants that go out to a variety of community-based organizations and nonprofits. Our Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, or you might hear it called WIOA in some of your other hearings or places, is our federal youth program that we run. And these programs serve primarily out-of-school youth, so people who are already disconnected from K-12 through their secondary credential completion, job experience that could happen in a paid job experience or in an internship, and also enrollment in post-secondary opportunities. And these programs are administered by our 9 local workforce development boards across the state. The HEC role in administering these programs is around grant funding, technical assistance, monitoring and accountability for both the fiscal and programmatic aspects.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this sounds a lot like what the Youth Development Council, the same population. Why is this so separated out from that? Why do these not work in coalition or out of the same department? Or not that you are necessarily going to be able to answer that, but
Madam Co-Chair, while I can't answer the how of why we're in different agencies, I can describe that the Youth Development Commission actually has a broad, they serve youth 6 to 24. They really look at the connections between various programs in a variety of state agencies, including the Department of Education, the OYA, the Oregon Youth Authority, et cetera. I actually just had coffee yesterday with a staff member there, so we are coordinating with them in terms of not duplicating efforts, but there is a lot of overlap in different at-risk youth groups that we're talking about, and there certainly is more demand than the different programs that we all provide.
Thank you.
Okay. When I use the words at-risk and opportunity youth, I'm really talking about young people who have significant economic and employment barriers. Some of them are listed on this slide. Most of the individuals we serve have multiple barriers. Many of them are people who are experiencing generational poverty or may not be the first person in their family to be an ex-offender. So these are places where we're trying to really stop a cycle and get those folks engaged in their next opportunity. Our participation numbers are listed here for you, and we serve about 1,300 people in our summer program through the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps per biennia, about 1,200 in the school year program, and our federal programs we serve about 5,800 youth. And we measure success in a variety of ways for the programs.
Representative Wisnik. Yep.
Well, thank you. Just before you get away from the youth conservation. Karen, thank you for the presentation and talk about this. I'm a supporter of the program. I see the vans all summer. Mm-hmm. I have friends that are involved in the program of looking after this. I do need to put on the record that I have in my district several private firefighting companies that do look at this as sort of their business. So I'm not opposed to the program. I'll not vote against it or funding, but it does affect some of my companies in my district.
Representative Wisnett, members of co-chairs, through the co-chairs, I would just describe that none of our youth crews actually do firefighting, but they do a lot of riparian work and other work on our public lands, hopefully to prevent some of that.
Mr. Chair, they do that. They don't fight fires year-round, so they have to. It's an important part of our defense against fires in this state to have private. We can't afford to have permanent people, so they do that kind of work during when they're not fighting fires. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Final slide. So we measure success of the young people in these programs through a variety of measures. As I mentioned, these are folks who haven't necessarily completed their high school diploma or credentials, so we make sure that they are completing. We look at the wages that they earn and the hours that they work. We also look at gains they have in particular areas in literacy and numeracy, and then also look at whether they are entering into post-secondary education or a job. We also look at the number of individuals who receive the National Career Readiness Certificate and use that certificate as part of their essential skills requirement for the high school diploma.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to make a brief comment. One of the things that I did in my nonprofit was deal with that pipeline that didn't exist into the workforce and into college. And what I didn't notice from here is institutional and systemic forms of racism. One of the biggest barriers that we found, particularly amongst our youth of color, was anytime they did these types of programs, the majority of the staff did not have the training nor the cultural competency to actually retain the youth. And I, you know, I'm not asking for statistics on your retention rates and your recruitment rates, but one of the things that our organization ended up doing instead of putting young people into these places is consulting to figure out how do you build appropriate environments and safe environments for people who are different. I guess, like, I know I didn't see that in the list of things, but biggest thing that our organization dealt with is racism that exists in our society. Mm-hmm. And as a huge barrier to them getting access to these opportunities.
Representative Hernandez and through the co-chairs. I think it's important, as you actually heard a little bit about the equity lens we use at the HEC. We're certainly aware of those issues that you've brought up. As part of our crew training, our crew leader training for OICC, we do provide cultural competency training, et cetera. I can get you some information, and there is actually a link in your slides about who we're serving in terms of ethnicity and race, and so we can make sure you have that information as well.
We're going to transition now to, thank you, Karen. I'll invite Patrick Crane, the director of our Community College and Workforce Development Office, to join us for the sort of next section. So we've been focusing on this, the transition of young Oregonians from school or out of school into training and higher education, whether through programs like OICC and the youth work programs that are that we support through federal investments in WIOA. We're now going to shift to that second category of transitions that I described at the outset, the transitions from secondary to post-secondary education and within post-secondary education. And Patrick will take us through that.
Great. Thank you, Ben. Good morning, co-chairs Monroe, Smith, Warner, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Patrick Crane, HEC's director of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. In this section, we'll transition from looking at pre-college supports that provide resources and information to prospective students to looking at some of the academic transitions between secondary and post-secondary. I'll discuss some of the ways that HEC coordinates activities to improve student transitions across sectors, and specifically we'll address career and technical education, career pathways, college credit when in high school, including both accelerated learning and APIB, developmental education, and math pathways. Helping align pathways and smooth transitions for students is one of HEC's primary focus areas. I know this has been a theme that Ben has returned to several times in his comments, and one of the focal points for having a commission such as the HEC to help coordinate across sectors of education. The work is primarily conducted, that I'll talk about in this section, by the Office of Community College and Workforce Development, which has about 14.7 FTE, and the Office of University Coordination, which has 5 FTE. These activities are integrated into the agency budget, which will be presented on our final day. But as we go through these different initiatives, I'll attempt to flag the number of FTE associated with each body of work. Before going into a description of some of the activities, I thought it was important to frame some of the why behind the effort in these areas and some of the urgency for efforts in these areas. These aren't an exhaustive list of data points or rationales for focusing in these areas, but they do illustrate some of the misalignments between secondary and post-secondary education, as well as some of the ways that higher education can actually play a role in increasing both high school graduation and college going. Two of these initiatives, specifically CTE and accelerated learning, advocates for Measure 98 pulled together research-based evidence that indicated their role in increasing high school graduation rates. Insofar as these activities also allow students to earn credits while in high school, these are affordability measures as well and enable students to save money by earning credit and focusing their interest and attention while in high school before transitioning to post-secondary education. So career technical education means content, programs, instructional strategies based on business and industry workplace skills, technical skill needs in 16 career clusters. CCWD, the Community College and Workforce Development Office, works in partnership with the Oregon Department of Education to coordinate the post-secondary component of career and technical education, supported primarily by federal funding through the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act. HEC receives approximately $900,000 a year in Perkins funding. This is used to support staff at the HEC who review and approve career and technical education programs, provide technical assistance to faculty and staff at community colleges around the state, and engage in educational and workforce partners in career and technical education conversations. We have 4 FTE devoted to this area, 3 full-time, and then 3 part-time using a mixture of state and federal funding. The Career Pathways Initiative is something that originated from the community colleges themselves going back to 2005. They recognized the need for shorter-term workforce credentials, something that Representative Parrish brought up on either day one or day two, and created the short-term career pathway certificates of between 12 and 44 credits that focus specifically on technical skills that are needed by workforce employers in the region and are embedded within associate degree programs. The strategic fund has been used to develop these programs, support faculty and staff time across the 17 community colleges, and also support partnerships with local employers, workforce development boards, high schools, and industry partners. The legislature allocated $600,000 in funding in 2016, and that was allocated in 20 equal amounts of $30,000 to the state's community colleges, Portland Community College receiving four shares because of their four campuses. What that money has been used for by the colleges has really been to align their career and technical education, career pathways programs with local sector strategies, local workforce needs, and build in partnerships with employers and high schools. Part of that's around aligning curricula. Part of it's around career readiness. Part of it's also around job shadowing, internship, interview preparation, really looking at a number of ways that colleges can partner with employers. Funding for this comes from the Strategic Fund, and that will be renewed next biennium at approximately $2 million. That funds a full-time statewide pathways director that is housed at Portland Community College, but coordinates very closely with CCWD, as well as a portion of both my time and our education division director, Donna Llewellyn's time. Another area where we attempt to...
I was just going to clarify, Mr. Chair, that the strategic fund is really a carve-out or a small amount of money taken off of the top of the community college support fund prior to distribution to the community colleges.
That's great. We'll go. I'll go into greater detail about that during the community college day, I believe next Wednesday. So delivering high-quality college credits in high school has been another major area of interest and focus for the HEC over the last couple years. And it's one of the ways that we attempt to improve transitions from secondary to post-secondary and assist Oregonians in completing certificates and degrees while earning college credits in high school and saving money. Through ORS 340-310, HEC was charged with developing standards for dual credit and other high school-based college credit partnerships. In March 2015, a group called the Accelerated Learning Work Group was formed by the University Provost Council and the Community College Council of Instructional Administrators. They worked together for about a year, and in June of 2016, new standards for accelerated learning in Oregon were adopted. Without going into great detail, although I'm happy to provide follow-up material or spend more time on this if it's of interest to the committee, the three models for dual credit that were in the new learning standards. One is the traditional dual credit model where college courses are taught in the high school by a certified high school instructor. A second model is what's referred to as sponsored dual credit. Again, taught in the high school, but the high school teacher is working in partnership with a college or university instructor who's qualified to teach the course. It provides the opportunity for expanded availability of course offerings. For example, if high school teachers are not themselves qualified to teach these courses, by partnering with a local community college, it expands what they can take. The third model is assessment-based learning credit. This is where credit is connected to students demonstrating mastery of content that is at a college level through assessment. It recognizes college level achievement without requiring the course to align one-to-one with the college course itself. And that credit comes in as assessment-based credit, similar to credit for prior learning, which I'll also touch on briefly here in a couple slides.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Crane, I think this is one of the most successful things the legislature's done, and HEC has led that effort. I hate to say, but I think that, you know, sometimes we have to pat ourselves on the back, and this is one I think I'd like to see if we could have data that we can, you know, talk about how much we've saved students. I know that several friends I have that their kids go to school with one semester paid for, or even two semesters, are already accomplished and things like that. I think we should try to let parents and students know, work in high school and you can save yourself a lot of money. So if we can put a financial numbers on this, what we've done here, I think it's a great achievement for the that we've done. And I hope you continue to have work from the K-12 people and the universities and coming up with who's qualified to teach or not. I know that's been a little problem, but continue it. I think it's a great program. And but I think maybe we should pat ourselves on the back on this one and talk about how much we've saved students and parents.
Great. Representative Wisnett, co-chairs, thank you for your comment. I'll go through a little bit of data about this over the next couple slides. The financial savings to students are not included, but we're happy to provide that information for you.
Yeah, Representative Wisnett, I taught in both of those programs for 20 years, both advanced placement, which was certified by the high school that I was teaching at, and then I went to something called Project Advance, which was certified by the local community college, who recognized me as being qualified to be a college professor of that particular subject, and gave my students college credit. Both those programs that I taught in gave students an opportunity to earn college credits in high school and had tremendous advantages. Virtually all of my students went on to success in school and college, so it is a marvelous opportunity and we need to encourage more of it. And Measure 98 really speaks to that as well. One of the aspects of Measure 98 is dual credit and opportunities for dual credit. Mr. Crane.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. So the slide you have before you is a look at the increase in the number of dual credit students between 2011-12 and 2015-16. As you can see, the numbers are moving up to the point where we have approximately 40,000 high school students earning dual credit in the year 2015-16. And they're doing well. If you look at the box on the side, the community college dual credit students took 8 credits on average and passed 95% of their dual credit courses. We don't have corollary information for the universities, which is why they're not included. But from the community college side, which represents 85% of dual credit students, you can see that they're doing quite well. Taking a closer look at the demographics of the students, as I mentioned, just over 40,000 students took dual credit in 2015-16. The majority, a slim majority, are women. And by race ethnicity, you can see them broken down by racial and ethnic groups. One of the challenges that remains is making sure that dual credits are available to students of all racial ethnic groups at all high schools, regardless of geography around the state. And we recognize that. Education Northwest took a close look at accelerated learning data from a couple years back, 2008-09 through 2012-13. And one of the things that they found is, on the whole, community college dual credit students are more likely to be white, female, high achievers, and not eligible for federal school lunch programs. Looking at the 15-16 data, you can see that it's more representative than probably the earlier data was, but there is certainly room for improvement, and that's something that we're cognizant of and working towards. And just so you're aware, in terms of what these credits are, what are students taking, 20% of the offerings are in career and technical education, 19% in math, followed by foreign language, physical sciences, English, and social sciences. So in terms of next steps, there are a couple things that we're focused on. One, as I mentioned, is focusing on equitable access across all of Oregon, regardless of race, ethnicity, geographic area, or socioeconomic status, but also making sure that the credits students are earning are the right credits that they can use to meet certificate, degree requirements, general education requirements, major requirements, that they'll transfer as seamlessly as possible from the high school into their chosen post-secondary institution. Out of the accelerated learning work group that I mentioned earlier, two other groups have developed. One is an oversight committee and one is a work group. The oversight committee is staffed by HEC, and that will actually approve programs around the state to make sure that they're aligned with the new standards that were adopted by the HEC in 2016. A second group that's called the Sustainable Systems for Accelerated Learning Work Group. This is staffed by the Chief Education Office and has representatives from ESDs, K-12 schools, community, universities, community colleges, and agency staff. And what they're charged with is essentially informing the future vision of what an ideal model for accelerated learning looks like in Oregon. It also provides a forum for all of the relevant partners to have discussions about where there may be points of tension or disagreements and to develop a system that works well, as well as an opportunity to both collect and analyze data so we can maximize both the time investment for students and the state investment of resources. Another area where we work to help students earn college credit while in high school, Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate. This is an area where the HEC convenes a work group. This work group originated in 2005 and has representatives from the College Board, International Baccalaureate, and faculty from Oregon Community Colleges and Public Universities. And what they're charged with is looking at the minimum scores that are acceptable for credit transfer amongst AP and IB courses. So this work takes about 0.1 FTE on the part of the HEC. We really are just a convener, and this group gets together, I believe, once per year.
Can I ask a quick one on that?
Madam Co-Chair.
Just very briefly, is this, so haven't we been doing this for a year? Oh, yeah, since 2005,
mm-hmm.
We've been doing this. Okay, yes. I just wanted to clarify this. So this is kind of an ongoing, this isn't a new thing, this is ongoing to make sure every year it's still working, tweak,
exactly.
Et cetera.
So, great. Madam
thank you.
Co-Chair, thank you. And the decisions that the colleges and universities make about cut scores and credit transfer are very stable over time. This
Great.
Is an opportunity to just check in and reengage.
Great.
I just have two more slides in this
okay.
section.
Okay, and then we'll call it a day.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So aligning math pathways, this is an area of work that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and the State Board of Education mutually agreed was of interest and importance to them when they met jointly in 2016. And the goal here is to ideally create a math curriculum that is seamless from both K-12 all the way through higher education. This work builds on some initiatives that were taking place within the community colleges, but also in partnership with universities around identifying math pathways that move beyond algebra calculus, but actually look at a statistics pathway that is perhaps more relevant for social science majors or quantitative reasoning, quantitative literacy courses that are perhaps more relevant for humanities students. Some of the next steps in this work are actually there's a meeting at 1 o'clock this afternoon with Salam Noor and a couple others from the HEC and ODE to talk about how we can move this forward. But it's really about bringing together mathematics instructors from around the state, from across sectors, to talk about what sorts of knowledge, skills, and abilities students need to have, and what sorts of changes to teaching and pedagogy may engage students more fully in this. The final area that I'll touch on in this section is developmental education redesign. As we know, about 65% of students entering community college in Oregon have to take at least one developmental education course. It's usually in math, may also be in English writing. And recognizing that this was an area of concern, the community colleges started working on this themselves back in 2013. This is an initiative that was also funded out of the strategic fund, but received $600,000 in legislative funding in 2016. Really, the focus has been on looking at national best practices and then changing how placement is done, looking at new delivery models for these courses, and with a particular focus from the legislative funding on co-requisite models for developmental English and writing. And what that means specifically is rather than putting students in a developmental course, and then the next term they take a 100-level course. They move directly into the 100-level course and receive additional supports simultaneously. It's been proven to show much higher success rates for students.
That's good, because this has been a problem for some time. You know, students graduating from college or from high school with all the necessary credits, and then they get to the community college and have to basically take high school level math and reading and writing over again. And that seems like a terrible waste. So anything we can do to attack this problem so that our students that are graduating from high school are actually qualified to do college level work, wonderful. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I just wanted to say, I mean, I was briefly on the higher ed committee when I first came in and went to an NCSL meeting about, there is so much good information mm-hmm. about better way, you know, getting us past our old traditional ways of, well, your remedial will remediate you in this way. Same course with extra supports, you know, the remedial kid takes a two-hour class instead of a one-hour class, all of that. And just there's so much good evidence on the difference that it makes.
Absolutely.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Wilson, next Monday?
Next Monday, sort of the same type of stuff going through GED and I think the Office of Private Post-Secondary Education, a few other areas.
Okay. Questions of anybody? Comments? Thank you very much, and we're adjourned. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned.